Welcome to another Joy 94.9 podcast.
Hello and welcome to Reality Check. Today is Monday, the 31st of May, 2010, and I'm your host, Tony Pittman. And this is episode 38 of Reality Check here on Joy 94.9. Reality Check is a show designed to give you a healthy dose of reality. And we do that by promoting the art of critical thinking and skeptical analysis. Each week we bring you a roundup of LGBT news, followed by an in-depth analysis of an issue related to the paranormal or the pseudoscientific. And finally, we wrap up each show with a movie review. On today's show, after our LGBT news roundup, we're going to make our first foray into the world of herbal remedies. And in particular, we're going to examine the popular herb known as echinacea. With winter now upon us, many people are heading off to their local health food stores to stock up on jars of echinacea to supposedly ward off those nasty winter colds. But is that really a wise way to spend your money? Does echinacea actually work to prevent and treat colds? Well, that's what we'll try to find out. Then in our movie review, we'll have a look at the Argentinian movie that won this year's Oscar for Best Foreign Language Film, The Secret in Their Eyes. So for all that and more, stay tuned here on Reality Check on Joy 94.9. Okay, here's our LGBT news roundup for the last week or so. And let's start with a really good news story. It's very rare that we get to report a wonderful surprise like this on Reality Check. But I'm delighted to tell you, dear listener, that Stephen Mongeza and Tiwonge Chimbalanga, the couple in Malawi who 2 weeks ago were sentenced to 14 years jail with hard labour for holding an engagement ceremony, well, just last Saturday, May 29th, they were given an unconditional pardon by the president and released from jail. Yes, their legal ordeal is now over, just like that. Amazing, isn't it? Now, the president's decision was made during a visit to Malawi by the United Nations Secretary-General Ban Ki-moon, during which he urged the president to pardon the couple and, during an address to the Malawian parliament, condemned in no uncertain terms the continuing existence of laws that make homosexuality illegal, and called on all countries with such laws to reform their penal codes. And dear listener, just for your information, according to an ILGA report released a couple of weeks ago, there are still 76 countries in the world where same-sex attraction is a crime. And in 7 of those countries, it's punishable by death. So it's pretty obvious that all that international pressure from Ban Ki-moon and others paid off, and the Malawian president felt forced to issue the pardon. But he did it through gritted teeth, and when announcing the pardon, he just had to add a few nasty comments saying that he was only doing it for humanitarian reasons and emphasizing that homosexuality was still illegal in Malawi and was, quote, totally wrong. And soon after, some other members of the Malawian government came out to say that Stephen and Tawonge will be rearrested if they don't change their behaviour. Still, at least the pardon was issued and the two were freed. Now, apparently since being released on Saturday, Stephen and Tawonge have understandably kept a very low profile. Apparently they've returned to their home villages separately and are now staying with their respective families, who reportedly don't want them to see each other again. It's been suggested that probably the safest move for them will be to leave Malawi, but I don't know how likely that is. I also read that Stephen turned to alcohol soon after getting home to drown his sorrows after the trauma of those 5 months in prison. So not really a happy ending to this story, but at least they won't have to spend 14 years in jail for no reason. So that's something to be happy about. Now, while we're still in southern Africa, let's move on to a bad news item, and that comes from nearby Zimbabwe. Now, homosexuality is illegal in Zimbabwe, and the country's charming president, Robert Mugabe, has been particularly outspoken about LGBT people over the years, calling them, quote, worse than dogs and pigs. Despite this hostile environment, Zimbabwe does have an LGBT rights group called Gays and Lesbians of Zimbabwe, or GALS for short. But unfortunately, on Friday, 21st of May, the police raided the GALS office in Harare, confiscating all their computers and other materials and taking two employees into custody, Ellen Chademana and Ignatius Muhambi, charging both of them with possession of pornography and the crime of insulting President Robert Mugabe. Ellen and Ignatius were then tortured over several days while in police custody, being forced to remain in squatting positions for long periods and being beaten on the knees with bottles, as the police tried to extract information from them about other GALS members. Fortunately, though, the two were released on bail last Thursday, May 27th, but they're still facing trial, which is set to begin on June 10th. Meanwhile, the police are continuing their harassment of GALS, and last Wednesday, May 26th, they raided the home of GALS director, Chesterfield Samba, confiscating his passport and birth certificate. So really a very grim situation there in Zimbabwe at the moment. And just as one criminal prosecution of LGBT people ends in southern Africa, another one unfortunately begins. But whatever happens, dear listener, we will of course keep you updated of any developments in both these cases as they occur here on Reality Check. Now, let's head north, way north, for our next news item to the capital of Russia, Moscow. Now, last week we reported that the attempted gay pride parade in Minsk in Belarus had ended very quickly when police swooped in to arrest many of the marchers. And I predicted that the same thing was likely to happen at the gay pride parade that took place in Moscow this past Saturday, May 29th. Well, I'm happy to report that my psychic powers were not working too well last week. My prediction was wrong. The march did take place in Moscow and no marchers were arrested, fortunately. Although I must admit that the event didn't exactly take place under ideal conditions. The Pride Parade had been banned several days earlier, and on Saturday, both anti-riot police and homophobic mobs were roaming the streets of Moscow to try to find out where the march was going to take place. In the end, the march organizers managed to issue enough false information to put everyone off their trail. And finally, they were able to hold a flash mob-style gay pride march. About 30 people came together all of a sudden from different locations, unfurled a big rainbow flag, and marched, and actually ran, literally, about 500 meters in front of the world's media and press photographers. Then, after just 5 minutes, they packed everything up and dispersed back into the streets of Moscow before the police or the homophobic mobs could find them. So, a success in that they got publicity, they made a point, and no one was arrested. But still, hardly ideal. Hopefully, next year, the nasty homophobic mayor of Moscow, Yuri Luzhkov, will have been removed from office, and a new mayor will allow the Pride March to go ahead under relatively normal conditions. Well, Luzhkov's term is not due to expire until July next year, but one can always hope that somehow he leaves early. Now, for our final news item, let's cross the Atlantic and head to Washington, D.C., where big advances were made last week in the battle to end the notorious Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy that prevents openly LGB people from serving in the United States military. And I say LGB people and not LGBT people because transgender people are not allowed to serve in the military, and the proposed reforms, unfortunately, do not include them. But as to these latest developments, well, the U.S. House of Representatives voted 229-186 on Friday to approve a defense bill that includes a provision that would remove the legislative ban on LGB people from serving in the armed forces. Now, the bill still has to get through the Senate, but last Thursday, the Senate Armed Services Committee voted 16-12 in favor of repeal. So that means that the measure will now pass to the full Senate for a vote. And that's expected sometime in June or July. Now, what this bill effectively means is that the Congress, the legislature, is passing the ball to the executive and saying, "We, the legislature, wash our hands of this whole affair. It's up to you guys to decide whether to let openly LGB people serve or not." Which is pretty much the way it always had been until 1993, when Congress introduced the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy during Bill Clinton's first term. So this is very good news, because given that Obama and Gates and Mullen have all come out in favor of repealing Don't Ask, Don't Tell, it should mean that if the Senate passes the bill, it then becomes just a question of when the policy will be abolished and not if. But why all this sudden urgency for Congress to take action on this now? Well, because a lot of political analysts fear that after the midterm elections in November, the Democrats will lose quite a few seats in the Congress, and therefore getting the repeal through after November will be much trickier. So anyway, it's all eyes on the Senate now to see what it does in the next few weeks. But have no fear, dear listener, we will, of course, keep you informed of every development here on Reality Check. But for today, I'm afraid that's all the LGBT news we have time for. Let's listen to a song now, and when we come back, we'll have a look at that popular herbal remedy used to treat and prevent colds, supposedly echinacea. Feel a sniffle coming on? Filled with the urge to rush down to your local supermarket and buy a bottle of echinacea before it gets any worse? Well, before you do that, I'd advise you have a listen to what we have to say after this song here on Reality Check on Joy 94.9.
And then there was Joy. Joy 94.9.
Welcome back to Reality Check. I'm Tony Pittman and the station is Joy 94.9. And the song you just heard there was Not Gonna Get Us by Russian pop duo Tattoo, who are apparently not really lesbians, but certainly play on a lesbian image as part of their marketing. Anyway, I played that song as a tribute to all those valiant LGBT activists in Moscow on Saturday who risked arrest and violence to stage a brief but successful LGBT pride parade. Okay, we move now into the part of the show where we undertake a skeptical analysis of a subject related to pseudoscience or the paranormal. And tonight, with tomorrow being the first official day of winter here in Australia, I thought it would be an appropriate time to undertake a skeptical examination of the most popular herb used to supposedly prevent and treat colds, echinacea. And because this is actually our first foray into the realm of herbal remedies here on Reality Check, I thought that first up we'd have a look at herbal remedies in general, and then look specifically at echinacea and whether it really is effective at warding off those nasty wintertime ailments. So first of all, let's have a skeptical look at herbal remedies in general. Now, as you've probably noticed, herbal remedies are extremely popular. Go down to your local supermarket and walk along the health foods aisle, and along with all the vitamin and mineral supplements, all largely useless, as we saw in a previous episode of Reality Check, you'll also find shelves and shelves of all kinds of herbal concoctions, making all kinds of claims to treat and prevent all kinds of illnesses. You'll find the ginkgo and the ginseng, the St. John's wort and the evening primrose oil, the saw palmetto and the black cohosh, the valerian and, of course, the echinacea. And the list goes on and on and on. And not only can you buy them in pill form, but you'll often find herbal remedies added to many other food products to supposedly give them some kind of extra benefits, particularly all those energy drinks and herbal teas. People generally think that because herbs are quote-unquote natural, they must be, first of all, effective, that is, they work, they do what they say they do, and secondly, they must be safe. So are people right to hold these beliefs about herbs? Well, it depends on the herb, but generally no. Most herbs, it turns out, are not effective, and some are not even safe. Black cohosh is a good example of one known to cause liver damage, for example. Now, let me try to explain to you the basic problem that skeptics have with herbal remedies. One thing they do have going for them is that they are not completely implausible. Unlike homeopathy, for example, when you take a herbal remedy, you are actually taking something, and that something might contain an active ingredient that could have an effect in your body. So herbal remedies are, at first glance, plausible. You don't have to break all the laws of physics, chemistry, and pharmacology to explain how they could work, unlike a lot of other alternative medicines we've seen here on Reality Check. And remember, a lot of the pharmaceuticals we use today come from plants, so it's quite plausible that plant products could have an effect on the body. But for herbal remedies to work, they must contain an active ingredient. If you take a leaf or a flower of some plant and grind it up to make a remedy, well, for it to actually work, it must contain, amongst all those ground-up components, some kind of active ingredient, some kind of molecule that is absorbed into the bloodstream and then binds with certain receptors on the membranes of certain cells in order to have an effect on the body. I mean, that's just basic pharmacology. That's how any substance you take will have a medicinal effect on the body. And so the first point to note about herbs is that when people say, oh, I prefer to take herbs rather than processed pharmaceuticals because herbs are natural and safe, well, that's just nonsense. Herbs are drugs, just like pharmaceuticals. If they contain an active ingredient, it's exactly the same active ingredient, exactly the same molecule as what you'd find in a pharmaceutical. Let me give you a very obvious example. Aspirin is a substance called acetylsalicylic acid. It's a molecule containing 9 carbon atoms, 4 oxygen atoms, and 8 hydrogen atoms. And when you take an aspirin tablet, that molecule is absorbed into the bloodstream and then binds to certain cell receptors, and that causes a reduction of pain signals transmitted to the brain. Now, if you want the same effect but as a herbal remedy, you just have to grind up the bark of a willow tree and drink it. It contains salicin, which is a very similar molecule to acetylsalicylic acid, and has pretty much the same effect. But the point is, they're both drugs. They're both just molecules that bind to your cells. And it doesn't matter whether you got that molecule into your body by taking it as a pill or by drinking ground up bark. So the idea that herbal remedies are somehow fundamentally different from manufactured pharmaceuticals is completely wrong. They are essentially the same. And this example that I gave of aspirin leads me to the main problem with herbal remedies. And that is the problem of knowing what you're getting. When you take an aspirin tablet, it will say on the pack, each tablet contains 500 milligrams of acetylsalicylic acid. And that's just what you'll get, 500 milligrams of acetylsalicylic acid, the active ingredient. Nothing more and nothing less. Whereas when you take a herbal remedy, there are a lot of uncertainties that come into it. Even if the herbal remedy does contain an active ingredient, and many of them don't, how do you know how much active ingredient it contains? It doesn't say on the pack. It will just tell you how much of the ground-up plant you're getting, not how much active ingredient. And this is important. There are lots of uncertainties about how much active ingredient that particular quantity of ground-up plant contains. First, which part of the plant did they use? The leaf? The flower? The fruit? The stem? The bark? Or the root? They all contain different concentrations of active ingredient. And if they used the leaves, well, did they take the new budding leaves from the top or the old established leaves from lower down? And which particular species or subspecies of the plant was it? And what time of year was it harvested? And in what type of soil was it grown? Under what conditions? And once harvested, how was it prepared? Were any other substances added? And if so, what were they? All these factors and many others will influence how much active ingredient the final product contains. The trouble is, because the sale of herbal remedies is almost completely unregulated, it's impossible to know any of these things. If you buy capsules of ginkgo, for example, you really don't know anything about what you're buying, except that it presumably contains some part of a ginkgo plant. Now, if ginkgo does contain an active ingredient, you have no idea how much that capsule might contain. If it's 1 gram of ground-up ginkgo, well, you've just got 1 gram of ground-up plant matter. You don't know how much active ingredient is in it. And that's the problem with herbal remedies as opposed to pharmaceuticals. Because when you buy pharmaceuticals, you know the exact amount of the active ingredient you're getting. With herbs, you have no idea and you have no way of finding out. So that's the first main problem with herbal remedies. Now, the other problems are determining whether a particular herb actually contains an active ingredient to start with, and then whether that active ingredient does what the marketers of the herb claim it does. Whether it improves memory or reduces the symptoms of menopause or sends you to sleep or whatever. So when dealing with these questions of effectiveness of various herbal remedies, well, you can't make broad statements about herbs in general. You have to look at each herb individually and the claims being made for its use. And so tonight, the particular herb we're going to examine in that way is echinacea. Now, echinacea is a flower native to Central and Eastern North America, and was traditionally used by the Plains Indians for general medicinal purposes, treating wounds and infections, things like that. Today, the major claim made by marketers of echinacea is that it prevents and treats the common cold. Now, given that the Plains Indians didn't particularly use it for treating the common cold, how did this claim arise? Well, no one is really sure. Dr. Wallace Sampson, the editor of the Scientific Review of Alternative Medicine and a major debunker of quackery, investigated this question, and he thinks that this claim first arose in the 1960s after a Swiss herbal supplement maker on a trip to South Dakota was erroneously told that echinacea was used for cold prevention by Native Americans who lived in that area. And that seemed to him as good a basis as any on which to market this new herbal product. So that's where the idea that echinacea is used to treat colds comes from. Someone just made it up to sell more herbs. Not a very promising start to our investigation. So as Dr. Sampson says, there is no more reason to study echinacea to prevent colds than there is to study echinacea to prevent auto accidents. It was all just made up out of thin air. By the way, dear listener, just as an aside, when you start to investigate the history of claims made for herbal remedies, it's amazing how many of them seem to have just been made up, like this one, about 50 or 100 years ago. And when you think about all those hundreds of millions of dollars that have been spent over the years on various kinds of clinical trials trying to prove those claims that were just made up in the first place, well, it's all a bit depressing, really. Anyway, back to echinacea. So regardless of how the belief came about, echinacea is now widely believed to be a way to prevent and treat colds, and is certainly marketed that way. So the question to be answered tonight is, does echinacea in fact do that? And to find out the answer, we cannot rely on anecdotes from friends and family about how well echinacea has worked for them and how they haven't caught a cold since they started taking it and how even when they did catch a cold, it went away so quickly using echinacea. Nor can we rely on similar testimonials in magazines and websites. Anecdotes are not sound evidence. What we have to do is look at the results of controlled scientific studies reported on in the medical literature. Now, these types of studies normally involve finding a group of test subjects, normally uni students, and putting some on echinacea and some on a placebo, and then squirting a particular strain of rhinovirus up their noses and recording what happens. Rhinovirus is one of the viruses that causes the common cold. Now, obviously the methodology will vary slightly depending on whether you're testing echinacea's effectiveness at preventing colds or treating them once they've started, but I think you get the idea of how all this testing basically works. So, what's the result, you ask? What do all these scientific studies show? Well, believe it or not, dear listener, in July 2007, The Lancet, one of the most prestigious medical journals in the world, published a meta-analysis by scientists at the University of Connecticut concluding, and I quote, that echinacea decreased the odds of developing the common cold by 58% and the duration of a cold by 1.4 days. End quote. So, I guess that's it for Reality Check this week. The recommendation is go out and buy echinacea. Let's listen to our final song now, and when we come back, wait, what kind of study was that was published in The Lancet? Oh, a meta-analysis, you say? Oh, right, so maybe this is not all as cut and dry as it may first appear. Because, well, meta-analyses are not always as reliable as people might think. Well, why not? What's a meta-analysis, I hear you ask? Well, a meta-analysis is a way to use data from several studies to try to get a bigger sample size and so, hopefully, get a clearer and more statistically significant result. For example, if you have 5 separate studies of echinacea from around the world, one performed in Melbourne with 200 volunteers, one from San Francisco with 300 volunteers, one from Tokyo with 150 volunteers, etc., etc., what you can do with all those studies is pool the data from all 5 to end up with a data set from 1,000 volunteers. Now, theoretically, that gives you results that are more statistically significant and hopefully gives you a clearer picture of any effect that might be produced by the herb in question. In theory, anyway. Because there are a couple of major problems with meta-analyses like these. The first is that all those studies were performed by different people in different institutions under different conditions, using different methods, and maybe measuring slightly different things, and using different scales to record the outcomes. For example, if you're testing echinacea and recording the severity of cold symptoms, well, there's no standardized scale for data like that. There's no standardized system for measuring cold symptoms. So that makes it very complicated and often impossible to pool all those results from around the world and expect to get any meaningful result. The other problem with meta-analyses is that often some of the studies included in the data set are not of the same quality as some of the others. For example, they may have varying degrees of blinding and varying standards of scientific rigor. In other words, some of those studies may not have been performed under effective conditions to eliminate the bias of the researchers. And so one or two sets of biased data added to a larger data pool in a meta-analysis will only serve to skew the results of the entire meta-analysis. Or as Mark Crislip from Quackcast says, garbage in, garbage out. Which I'm afraid to say looks like what happened with that particular meta-analysis published in The Lancet, the one on echinacea. Some of the studies they included in that meta-analysis didn't mention whether blinding was used or not. And that's kind of relevant in deciding how trustworthy the results are. So when it comes to echinacea and other herbal remedies, meta-analyses are probably not the best studies to rely on. You're much better off looking for individual studies, but good quality ones. You see, the echinacea studies follow a very similar pattern to the homeopathy studies and studies on other alternative modalities that we know don't work. That is, the earlier, smaller, poorly controlled studies tend to show positive results. Whereas in the later, larger, higher quality studies, this apparent effect seems to go away. Now, the gold standard in scientific testing is the large-scale, randomized, double-blind, placebo-controlled clinical trial – And those are the kinds of studies we need to look for on echinacea, not the meta-analyses that could probably include data from some of those dodgier, smaller trials. And when these high-quality studies have been performed on echinacea, such as the 2005 study published in the New England Journal of Medicine, or the 2002 study published in the Annals of Internal Medicine, they show that echinacea has no effect on the prevention or treatment of colds. No effect whatsoever. Surprise, surprise. Now, finally, one more interesting thing to note about echinacea before we finish up. Well, in all the various preparations and doses in which it's been used, it's never really been reported to have any side effects. Now, think about that for a moment. Almost any active ingredient that is binding to your cells and having an effect in your body, almost any active ingredient will have side effects. If it works, if it affects your body in some way, it must have some side effects. Pretty much all pharmaceuticals have side effects. So to be able to take a medication like echinacea that supposedly only prevents infection by colds and has no other effects in the body, well, that would be basically unheard of. So the fact that echinacea doesn't have any side effects would seem to strongly indicate that it doesn't in fact contain any active ingredient and therefore doesn't actually do anything. And the results of the clinical trials would certainly seem to back up this conclusion. So, the reality check conclusion on echinacea is that, in all likelihood, it doesn't work. In fact, it doesn't do anything. So, if you want to avoid catching a cold this winter, don't waste your money on echinacea. Or vitamin C for that matter, but that's a subject for another episode of Reality Check. But don't worry, dear listener, there are real ways to avoid catching a cold based on real science. Now, there's no such thing as boosting your immune system, that's just a marketing term, but you can try to at least maintain a normal immune system by eating a balanced diet and getting plenty of sleep. But the most important way to avoid catching a cold is to avoid people who are coughing and sneezing. Colds are caused by viruses, and those viruses are spread via tiny water particles in the air, ejected when people cough and sneeze. Another way to avoid colds is by washing your hands regularly and trying not to touch your eyes, nose, and mouth. You can often infect yourself with a cold virus by touching a surface that someone else touched with their snotty, dirty, virus-infected hands and then transferring that virus to your upper respiratory tract through your face. So don't hang around sneezing people, don't touch your face, stay healthy, and above all, don't waste your money on echinacea. So those are your Reality Check lifestyle tips to make it through this winter. Now, finally, before we play our last song, if you have any questions or comments about echinacea, herbal remedies, or something else we've covered on the show, or maybe a topic you'd like us to cover, please feel free to send us an email. The address is realitychecktony, that's T-O-N-Y, @gmail.com. You can also visit our webpage too if you like, that's realitycheckonline.net. Okay, let's listen to our last song, and when we come back, we'll get into this week's movie review.
Cruising for joy? It's safe listening. Joy 94.9.
Hi, this is Howie D.
This is Brian.
This is Nick.
And this is AJ.
And we're the Backstreet Boys.
And you're listening to Joy.
Welcome back to Reality Check with me, Tony Pittman, on Joy 94.9. Also streaming live at joy.org.au and also available as a podcast to listen to anywhere in the world on your little pod. And the song you just heard there was Héroes de la Antártida by Spanish pop group Mecano from 1988. Okay, it's movie review time here on Reality Check, and the movie up for review this evening is the Argentinian movie that won the Oscar this year for Best Foreign Language Film, El Secreto de Sus Ojos, or in English, The Secret in Their Eyes. Now, the other nominees for the Oscar this year were the French film A Prophet and the German film The White Ribbon, both of which have been reviewed previously here on Reality Check. Also in contention were the Israeli film Ajami and the Peruvian film The Milk of Sorrow, which have yet to be released in Australia, although Reality Check's other half has already seen The Milk of Sorrow twice and highly recommends it. So something to look forward to in the near future, hopefully. But the point is that having beaten out all those good movies, especially The White Ribbon, which I loved, The Secret in Their Eyes really has a lot to live up to. And I must say this film has got a lot of love from the critics. It has a score of 80 on Metacritic and 92% on Rotten Tomatoes. And it's now the second highest grossing Argentinian film in history. So it all sounds pretty promising. Now, The Secret in Their Eyes tells the story of Benjamin Espósito, a retired federal justice agent living in Buenos Aires in 1999. He's decided to write a book about a murder case he worked on back in 1974. And the film switches constantly in flashback between the two periods, the 90s and the 70s. The victim of the murder under investigation was a young, beautiful, recently married woman. And initially, one of Benjamin's colleagues in the Justice Department arrests two construction workers just to get the case resolved quickly. Benjamin, however, doesn't accept this and goes looking for the real killer. The film then follows his investigation, as well as his budding romance with his new boss, Irene, and the unresolved consequences from both of these that are still haunting Benjamin in 1999 when he's writing the book. By the end of the movie, both the murder case and the romance finally come to some kind of resolution. Well, I have to say that The Secret in Their Eyes is not a bad movie, but in my opinion, it's definitely not worthy of all the acclaim it's been getting. It's got a fairly complex plot with quite a lot of twists and plot developments that keep you pretty engrossed throughout the whole movie, and so it's generally entertaining. But I'm afraid to say it's really not much more than that, and certainly not up there with a film of the caliber of The White Ribbon. On the positive side, one interesting element that the film has going for it is the setting. The events surrounding the murder investigation all take place from 1974 to 76, during the presidency of Isabel Perón, when the levels of political violence are increasing in Argentina in the build-up to the military dictatorship, which ruled from 1976 to 83. And that's an interesting and original backdrop for the events of the film. Also interesting is that for a country that was traumatized by that incredibly brutal period of military rule, the characters never refer to it directly during the film. One more notable feature of the film is one particular scene filmed in a very complicated, continuous, 5-minute camera shot that comes about a third of the way into the movie and all takes place in a packed stadium where a football match is underway. The scene begins with an aerial shot over the stadium, then the camera moves down into the crowd, shows the protagonists, and follows them as they search for the killer, find him, and then chase him underneath the stands and eventually onto the pitch. Apparently, it took 3 months of pre-production, 3 days of shooting, and then 9 months of post-production just for that one shot. It's pretty impressive. Just a shame that the movie itself doesn't really live up to the originality and technical prowess demonstrated in that one shot. So, although the setting is novel and interesting, and the director does use some interesting filmic techniques, the film itself is not really very groundbreaking or challenging in any way. It's actually fairly formulaic stuff. A bit of mystery, a bit of action, a bit of romance, and a happy ending. There are even some developments in the plot that are so contrived that they just seem a bit ridiculous. So in the end, the secret in their eyes is not really very different from the standard kind of mass-produced fare you normally get out of Hollywood. And in fact, that's probably why it won the Oscar. The Academy generally likes this kind of stuff, films that look kind of exotic and original, but never really take the average American viewer too far out of his or her comfort zone. So overall, The Secret in Their Eyes is an entertaining enough movie, but not one that I'd be rushing out to see in the cinema. Maybe if you've got a long-haul flight coming up, it's not a bad way to pass the time. Actually, why not check it out on your next flight to Buenos Aires in just a few weeks when you go there to celebrate the legalization of same-sex marriage? Well, fingers crossed. And that brings us to the end of the 38th episode of Reality Check on Joy 94.9. I hope you enjoyed the show. Remember to send any questions, comments, or feedback to realitychecktony@gmail.com and visit our website at realitycheckonline.net. And remember to tune in at 8 o'clock next Monday for episode 39. Coming up next, David presents An Awkward Pause. Have a great week, everyone. See you next week.
This has been another Joy 94.9 podcast. Joy 94.9 is a gay and lesbian volunteer-based community radio station committed to providing a voice for the diverse GLBTI communities. You can support our work by becoming a member or making a donation. For details, go to joy.org.au.